That's kind of conversation to your soul. That's conversation to your soul and the night.
Prestige heads, welcome to American Prestige. I'm Danny Bessner, here as always with my friend and comrade Derek Davison, and we're very excited to welcome to the podcast today Dylan Riley. Dylan's a professor of sociology at UC Berkeley, whose work has appeared in many places, including the New Left Review and other venues, and I am just personally a very big fan, so it is especially an honor for me to welcome you to the podcast, Professor. And we're here to talk about a bunch of different things, but first of all, just thank you so much for joining us.
Yeah, you know, thanks a lot for inviting me. And, you know, please call me Dylan and not Professor.
Professor is my dad's name. Why don't we start with this big discussion about political capitalism that has been roiling as much as any debate on the left could roil anything, the intellectual left over the last few years. And before we even get into your most recent interventions, which I've learned a lot from, I think it might be useful to actually recapitulate the so-called Brenner debate about falling rate of profit in contemporary capitalist societies. And for people who might not be familiar with this discussion that, I mean, really Marxists have been having for a long time, but I think in its most recent iteration, we could date back to the 70s and the coming online, quote unquote, of Germany and Japan as really massive economies. But Dylan, could you take us through the debate and then we could talk about your intervention in it?
Sure, Danny. Let me just try to kind of do it real quickly. The debate you're referring to really is, I guess it would be like the second sort of Brenner debate, the one that sort of follows from this, I think it was a 98 full issue publication in the New Left Review called The Economics of Global Turbulence that then appeared a few years later as a book. And the contention there was that the sort of starting point of that analysis was the idea that there had been a changeover from a long boom period following the Second World War from roughly 45 to 73. And then that had been followed by something called what Brenner called the long downturn. Obviously, that's, you know, many other people have written about these sort of two phases, which basically begins in the mid late 70s, and Brenner's telling, like, you know, as of around 2000 had continued right on through. And what was, you know, there had been obviously within the kind of Marxist universe, there were different ways of thinking about or accounting for that. Most of them having to do with the central issue was what explained this. And most Marxists focused on the idea of the so-called, falling rate of profit as the kind of main explanation. And then there are kind of various accounts of this notion of the falling rate of profit. Some of them rooted in the kind of labor theory of value and the idea of the increasing organic composition of capital. That is to say that since labor was the source of value, as you get more machinery, somehow that undermines profitability. Then there was another kind of group that was more kind of, we could say, kind of class struggle oriented, that the so-called profit squeeze theory that said, well, a problem here was the militants of the labor movement and that had somehow cut into profits. And Brenner's intervention at that time in this kind of debate was really to set both of those positions aside and to argue that the key to understanding this was the kind of competitive and anarchic character of capitalist investment, which had created a problem of, you know, what he characterized as systemic, that is to say, worldwide excess capacity, particularly in manufacturing, which had brought down rates of return across the developed world. And, you know, we can talk more about exactly why, what the mechanisms are. That was the basic position.
Yeah, let's talk about that for people who might not be familiar with Marxist theory. Just what is the logic of this excess capacity and why that would bring down the rate of profit over time? And I think it might be also worthwhile just to briefly mention what is the theory of the falling rate of profit. It's kind of self-explanatory, but maybe in Marxist terms, it's just worth going through for a second and then how Brenner explains that.
Sure. Yeah. I just want to very briefly touch on the basic account of the falling rate of profit and then kind of set it aside because I really don't want to get into a Gnostic debate.
Agreed.
The basic intuition that Marx had, if you think about Marx as arguing that the source of value is labor, his basic intuition, and this is the kind of orthodox Marxist position that I'm putting out, the basic intuition was that as the share of output that is contributed by labor declines with the accumulation of machinery and means of production, that is going to undermine basically the amount of surplus value produced, and that this will ultimately express itself in a tendency of the rate of profit to fall. That's kind of the orthodox Marxist position. Okay. The Brenner argument is extremely different from that. It doesn't rely really on the notion of a labor theory of value in that form at all. And the basic idea of the Brenner argument, which, you know, Marx in different places in Capital also makes an argument that is like this, and it's not so clear how it relates to this underlying labor theory of value. But the basic idea of the Brenner argument is that once you make an investment in a physical means of production, you're stuck with that investment. And it's not easy to kind of move, like capital is not completely fungible and liquid once it's fixed. And therefore, it's rational for producers, even if they're producing at a higher cost with a sort of lower level of technological development, it's rational for them to stay in the line of production that they're in, even as other more efficient competitors come in. And because of the fixed character of investment and its unplanned and uncoordinated nature, that tends to bring down the rate of return in the line as a whole. So the real key idea is the fixity of investment combined with the unplanned and anarchic character of investment. Those are the sort of two central ideas. I should say,
and I just want to say, just very, very quickly, Dylan, before you move on, I just want to say, I think this is a really important insight because I think you could actually expand it to other areas that aren't just about purely production. I think a lot in this way about infrastructure and how early investments in fixed infrastructure means it's much more difficult for like the Long Island Railroad to be fixed in the same way that China is doing bullet trade. So I think it's just like, even if like, one might disagree on particular. I think it's a very important insight about the fixed nature of actual means of production or means of whatever it may be. Sorry to interrupt.
No, I think you're absolutely right. And I mean, I would say there's even a kind of, you know, I think there's a kind of geopolitical element to this in the sense that I think what we're seeing right now with the transition to drone warfare and the kind of asymmetrical warfare you're seeing unfold in the Gulf of Hormuz right now, in a way, is an expression of a problem of sunk costs in basically what has become obsolete military technology on the part of the U.S. I mean, it's not... So I think this is a very general process.
And also, just very on that fun fact, this was called the Liberty Engine problem in the 1930s, because basically the U.S. had made such investments in a specific type of engine in the 20s. The government was unwilling to update these engines, so the U.S. had an Air Force that was lagging behind. So this is like a common problem of capitalist society, and just something in warfare you just see over and over and over again. The sort of fixed investment prevents... And then you get World War One, and you get radar in 2 years, you know. So World War Two, sorry, no, radar in 2 years.
But
yeah,
it's a quite general problem. Or you can think about. I mean, the other I think great example of this is the way that the Soviets basically are able to leapfrog, Wehrmacht technology in Operation Barbarossa, for example. So there are many, many examples of this sort of general thing. But the general idea is that once you put those investments in place, you're stuck with them and you're going to fight to get as much out of them as you can. You can't just sort of shift over to another line of production. So this is the idea. So the idea was, to go back to what we were saying before, is that, well, what happened was that as what you're talking about, particularly the German and the Japanese economies kind of came online toward in the 50s and 60s, instead of kind of neatly fitting into a global division of labor in which people were producing different things, you had a situation of ferocious competition, which brought down rates of return across the world. And that this is the underlying cause, as it were, of the long downturn. So that's the basic, that's the basic idea.
Really useful, really helpful. And I think it might make sense now to talk, to turn to the more recent debates and the more recent discussions about this. And particularly, I'm in my own work focused on this debate in the sense of how does capital try to overcome the falling rate of profit. I focus particularly on the media, and I see monopolization and financialization as essentially the two strategies embraced by capital when it comes to large corporations. And then you have the transition to asset holding, which I think is a much broader phenomenon beyond sort of the history of business. But how has this debate proceeded? And let's talk about your interventions as well over the last quarter century.
Well, obviously, people have passionately held and very divergent views on this issue. But the way that I'm thinking about it now is roughly this. I think in the contemporary debate, sort of contemporary left debate, there are kind of three positions, although they're often presented as two. And the three positions that I would put forward are, there's one group of scholars that is very committed, I'd say, to the idea that there's really nothing new going on. And this is, you can see this in the work of Maher and Aquino, for example, who are left economists, or in the work of Evgeny Morozov, who has written very critically about attempts to sort of periodize capitalism in the new period. And their argument is, it's some mix of the idea that, well, the state has always intervened in the economy to support rates of return. There's really nothing new here. And also, by the way, look how highly productive the tech sector is. We don't really have a slowdown. And then there are also sort of empirical debates about whether and to what extent the rate of profit is declining or increasing and what the implications of that are. So that's like one sort of bucket. The second group are the people who are advocating for the idea of techno-feudalism. And here, obviously, you have Jody Dean or Yanis Varoufakis or Cedric Durand. And the people who are making this argument, I mean, the way I understand their argument is the central idea is the notion of what they call a platform rent. And what that basically means is that you have this phenomenon in which the kind of value of a platform depends on the number of its users or the number of people who are interacting with it. And so its value can basically increase independently of whether or not it's actually a technically superior product or not. It's just people call these sort of network effects of everyone using the platform. And the argument is that given that the owners of the platforms are able to extract a rent from the platforms on those on that basis, which is like not like a capitalist profit exactly. And this is basically what the argument of Varoufakis and Durand is. The position that I've really been arguing for together with Robert Brenner, but also independently of Robert Brenner, is the notion of political capitalism. And kind of what I mean by that is really a system, it's a kind of more general argument that says that basically together with certainly a kind of conventional capitalist economy, which is rumbling on to some extent, there's arising a new political economy of predation in which rates of return are dependent on political relationships, not on cost cutting, increasing market share, and extracting, you know, what Marxists would call relative surplus value. And, you know, the kind of indicators of the of political capitalism, I think there are numerous of them. You mentioned the concept of asset price inflation, which strikes me as a central mechanism. That is to say, as the government and central bank policies are explicitly oriented to the support of asset price inflation, owners of assets that can gain returns that really have no relationship really to markets or to productive investment. They're just gaining rents on that basis. But I mean, in the latest period, we have even more it's just like open the newspaper. I don't really know how to get my head around what's happening, with the Trump administration over the last year and a half. But I mean, it doesn't strike me to be either techno-feudalism or just normal old capitalism going on here. We're entering something very new.
And you could even think about, I think about this again through deep research into the history of the media. I mean, there's a very specific examples. For example, the government telling the DOJ not to enforce certain rules against monopoly that are anti-monopoly. Then you have, just to put it in a term people might understand, like how did Disney get the capital to purchase all the other companies? They were essentially no longer enforcing monopoly rule, and then you have zero interest rates. And so those two things coming together are a collusion between effectively the government and different parts of the government to allow companies to monopolize in a way that, I mean, has at this point outstripped the Gilded Age, where oligarchy is now so extreme. So I think you could even see, I think asset prices are probably the base of this, but I see financialization and monopolization as being part of it, because there are actually laws on the books that the government is choosing not to enforce. And to me, that's the political element of political capitalism. So I see that is certainly coming together. And then just thinking from a more macro perspective, it raises larger questions about periodization, because Dylan, you read my recent piece. I think like the thing that I'm beginning to think through is that the era of ideological contestation might be over, and that even though social theory and social science emerged in a moment of particularly strong universalistic ideological contestation, it does seem to me that forms of capitalism have won. So maybe as that happens, you get a return to the state, or the political begins to reaffirm a type of dominance that it has once the question of the economy has been essentially answered for all intents and purposes, even though there are different versions of capitalism. So I think the focus on political capitalism, I like it because it allows you to ask much larger questions about periodization, the nature of economy, and the nature of really history in a capital H sense.
Yeah, I want to say, let me say a couple of things about that. It's a really interesting set of observations. One thing I would say is that although monopolization and the kinds of things that you're talking about are really obviously important phenomena to understand, I wouldn't want to say that the political capitalism depends on monopolization per se. It can actually be, political capitalism can emerge in a highly competitive way, in the sense that there can be essentially competition among different groups of capitalists over access to the state or political connections or whatever, right? So you can have a number of different political capitalists that are swilling at the trough and really in serious competition with one another. The important thing, though, is that the competition is not really a cost-price competition. It's a competition over access to political connections, which is, I think, deeply corrosive, among other things, of, you know, liberal democracy, for example, rule of law, the idea of a neutral, you know, Reichstag, and all of those kind of things. So I do think that that's...
Could I ask you a question? Can I ask you a question?
Mm-hmm.
So then let me ask a question, then, because I think I totally agree with the point. But when you look historically, they do seem to go together. I guess like almost every major American sector has now come down to between 3 and 5 gigantic conglomerations. So how do you think, just as a historical question, so maybe like theoretically, it's not necessary that you could, and I would say you actually do have different formations of capital. And this was that recent book on the Republican Party, I think it was called The Rogue Elephant, about how like American capital is actually maybe uniquely disorganized when compared to, yep, there you go. Right, exactly. Paul Heidemann, is that his name? We had him on,
yeah,
he was great.
Right. Yeah.
So that was excellent. And it really does show about the disorganization of capital between capitalist sectors, but like the media and Wall Street and the big box stores, they're essentially all between 3 and 5 conglomerations. So then like, how do you like think of that?
Yeah, no, I mean, I think that's a really good question. As I was saying before, that is a real phenomenon that should be acknowledged in this. But there's also just a broader phenomenon that I'll just put the issue this way. Even apart from these large, concentrated firms, a whole huge sector of the private economy, even small and mid-sized firms, are essentially like supported by, relatively cheap money and they're deeply indebted.
Totally.
And so it's just a more general dependency somehow. That's what I'm trying to, the idea I'm trying
I totally to. Agree. Totally agree. And then just maybe the other question is, how does financialization fit into that? Because that's often viewed as like the other major strategy. Like basically credit only explodes in the late 70s. You get the deregulation of the financialized economy between essentially 78 and 2008. So how does that play into the political capitalism framework?
I mean, I think it's very essential part of it. And I would say that it's basically a process of, it's an attempt to inflate asset prices. I mean, financial assets being among the central assets that are being inflated. It's just not restricted to that because, of course, we've got other things. For example, real estate is another really good example. And I'm thinking of Brett Christopher's work here, which I think is pretty excellent on that, or Melinda Cooper's work, which is also really good. So it's just this idea, I think that financialization is part of a general strategy of inflating asset prices. So I would just say it fits in as one of the things, a central thing that's going on. But I guess I would say we need maybe a slightly more general category to understand, why that's happening.
I totally agree. And this is actually opens up my thinking because essentially you put the asset price inflation at the top or asset value inflation at the top. And right below it, you have monopolization, which essentially leads to things like dividends and stock buybacks, were forms of asset price inflation that is encouraged by financialization. So the major category is asset price. And then below that or supporting it is the strategy of monopolization and financialization. And then real estate obviously an asset and how those work together. That makes a lot of sense to me.
Yeah, so that's the way I'm thinking about it. I mean, the question I have now is how seriously, I mean, I don't really know, what do I want to say about this? I actually think that we have to understand the period, I would say the whole period that opens in 2016, but is even more acutely evident in this second Trump term. Like, Trump can't be understood simply as a political phenomenon. There's an economic dimension to this, which is just incredible. And I think we need to have tools of understanding that. Like, what happens when the Internal Revenue Service is being turned into, really a machinery of extraction and distribution of wealth to the connected insiders? I mean, how systemic is this? I don't even know how to think about it. And I don't even think we know what the extent of this is. My sense is that the category of corruption is inadequate to explaining really what is happening here.
Yeah, the way that I view this, and this is probably my training as an intellectual historian, is that we're finally coming to the end of the progressive era, and that there was sort of progressivism merges with a type of liberalism in the 1920s and 1930s that I think really achieved hegemony and actually maintained hegemony from the 1930s until roughly 2024-ish. I mean, from this framework, and this is where I think I'd get some pushback, neoliberalism is actually a form of progressivism and liberalism writ large. And it was a strategy of liberals, broadly speaking, in the 19th century grand ideological sense to incorporate criticism and deal with the stagnation of mid-century Fordism, which was real, which was related to the fallen great prophet, and that we're living in an era where the almost ideological hegemony of that form of liberalism is totally coming apart, so that there's none of these normative pushbacks against the total corruption of Trump or the dismantling of the administrative state, or more broadly speaking, a particular element of the administrative state, because the military is actually still quite well-funded. And that's where someone like Quinn Slobodian's argument, I think, even though applied maybe in a different context, that like the military state is quite fine. We're getting the guns. We're just not getting the butter of the mid-century Fordist promise. And so I think we're in this very strange moment of political economic transition, but also ideological withering away. And as a historian, one of the strangest phenomena to me has been the lack of an emergent ideological frame through which to understand the problems of the present. And that is the thing that that essay that I sent you was trying to struggle through, is like, why hasn't there been that? Is it just that like Fukuyama was correct and that this is the end of history in the Hegelian sense that he meant it, and that the final idea was liberalism, except he thought liberalism would spread, but actually it's just the liberalism that's going away. So we're getting different forms of just like almost primitive accumulation style capitalism for an oligarchic elite. And obviously these ideas are inchoate and then they're in formation. But I think what I would like to do is to sort of bring the political capitalism element with the delegitimization and withering away of the liberalism element. And I think like that is the like very particular conjuncture that we're existing within, which is why I don't think like the fascism frame is useful. I think that was just such a different historical moment. It actually occludes understanding of what's actually going on. But that's my like working through framework.
No, I mean, there's a lot to there. You put a whole lot on the table. So let me like try to think about how I think about some of this stuff. So, I mean, I think that just to sketch it out very roughly, I think that there's a certain rationale to the Trumpist unraveling of the global international order. It's not completely insane. There is a deep underlying historical logic to it. And it's more or less, I think, the way to connect these things and to go back to some of the things that you were saying is to say, look, if we think about neoliberalism, I mean, the origins of neoliberalism are basically, you know, in the late Roosevelt years. And it's the idea of an open trade international order, right? And it's really based on, initially, as we were saying before, it's based on the incredible productivity of the U.S. manufacturing base that, you know, is both exporting to the whole world and then opens up its markets to its former enemies become allies, right? And it's this quite extraordinary moment that creates that, you know, it's the basis of the whole long boom. And obviously, then that goes through a profound mutation in the late 70s when, you know, the U.S. shifts over from becoming a global manufacturing power to becoming the world's kind of center of debt, right? But the system is able to kind of re-articulate itself around that, and that's what we call, I guess you could call that classic neoliberalism, or what most people are calling neoliberalism, which is a fine enough terminology. But it's clear that we're at the end of that system, or at the end of that order in some ways, and that what we're entering in now is a much more zero-sum world in which, you know, really the U.S. is just, the U.S. can no longer really afford politically or economically to be the linchpin of this global hegemonic order that it constructed. And so, what you're seeing is, as you, I think, very well describe in the piece that you were discussing, is the fragmentation into these sort of what you had sort of these three blocks, or sort of China, Russia, you know, the European Union, the US, something like that, or four sort of areas of influence. You're definitely seeing the world fragment back into those things, and a much more serious zero-sum competition develop. I also agree with you that this is not structured by an ideological conflict. And in that sense, I mean, if Fukuyama waffles back and forth, it's not clear whether he thinks he was wrong or still right. I mean, both, you can sort of see both arguments, right? I mean, in a sophisticated reading of Fukuyama, you could say, well, he's still right, because it is true that, you know, liberal democracy is somehow the horizon of all our possible futures. It's just that lots of places haven't achieved that yet. You know, I guess you can say that. But in the less sophisticated version, he obviously seems kind of wrong because of the clearly increasing levels of geopolitical tension, not just, you know, within the core zones, we could say, of capitalist modernity itself, I think, are beginning. So, I mean, I do think that we're in that kind of, we're in that sort of moment.
So, Danny, I just would push back a little bit on something you said earlier, which is that we're still getting guns, but not getting butter. We're paying for guns, but we're not getting guns either. Like, we're not getting guns that work. We're not getting, you know, we're not getting guns that do anything. We're paying massive amounts of money to contractors that don't deliver. You know, China may wind up, not that I, you know, think that this is an urgent thing, but China may wind up leapfrogging the United States in air technology if they produce the first sixth generation fighter, which they're currently, I think, ahead of the US in developing. And I think to a point that Dylan made earlier, it's become, that system has become another, fully now, I mean, it always was to some extent, but fully just another conduit for shuffling government money off to a handful of oligarchs. Like, it's the corruption is so intense. And I wonder, you know, I think we don't on this show talk enough about what a momentous change, I think, is happening here when you have a president who's making, you know, 4,000 stock trades in his first year and a half in office, who's, you know, manipulating the market on a weekly basis as he's, you know, futzing around with whatever he's doing with Iran now, like with profound ability to affect who wins and who loses on that level. And you're talking about corruption that isn't just like a government set up to support a particular class or a particular segment of society, but literally is benefiting like the president and his family and a handful of big donors. Like, it just seems so much more acute now. I feel like it needs to be considered something different. Maybe it's just an intensification, but it feels like something different.
Yeah, I agree with what you were just saying, Derek. I mean, I think if you think about, you know, obviously what is happening here, to put it in sort of terms of political sociology, is the undermining of the relative autonomy of the state, right? So if the classic capitalist state is supposed to act as, you know, a kind of relatively neutral umpire setting the rules of the road for capitalist reproduction, that's not what's going on here now, which I think, I mean, my expectation would be, and I think that in some ways, you know, you could say the Heidemann's book kind of sort of exemplifies this, is really you're going to get an increasing fragmentation among the ownership class, and you know, increasingly sharp elbowed conflicts as they jockey for position in relation to the state.
I want to turn to the fascism question in a second, but before we do, I would love to get your thoughts on things like the CapEx of these tech companies, the investment in artificial intelligence, because to me, like, and maybe I'm probably not as philosophically sophisticated, but there's a capital F fakeness about a lot of this. Like, I don't think they're actually generating profits. When you look at the actual revenue versus the CapEx of these companies, they're like exponential orders of magnitude different. And so it almost just seems like we're existing at this point in capitalism because capitalism has just taken over the world. And the US is an empire in decline and needs to have some evidence of productive investment having these gigantic valuations. But how does that play in, and how does AI play into this? Is it just another way to keep this asset values inflated after crypto and NFTs didn't work? And this one's like, could actually maybe get rid of labor? I'm curious your thoughts about that.
Yeah. I mean, obviously, you could say in one sense, we don't quite know yet. Maybe there will be some massive breakthrough in productivity that's generated by AI. I think I'm generally skeptical of it. So the key thing that I was looking at, you know, is, of course, so you think just these massive data centers that you're talking about that are being built in order to support the AI, it's the basic infrastructure of AI. As you're saying, I mean, these things are just driving a huge part of GDP growth. I think it's like 2/3 or something like that. And the other third is healthcare or something in the U.S. economy, right? And there was a recent very interesting article in the Financial Times that I don't know if you guys saw this, but it showed how, you know, the investments in these giant data centers, the debt that these data centers are accruing is starting to worry investors. And what they're doing is they're packaging it on and selling it off, right? Which sounds credit default swaps, a hell of a lot like a housing bubble, right, of 2017. Yeah. So, I mean, I just think that the signs are flashing red. And as you're saying, what exactly is the model, the profitability model here? I mean, they're going to get, is it a subscription model? Like we're going to pay for our AI? I mean, how's that going to work? How can that support this level of investment? Obviously, there are other things going on. I fully understand that it's being integrated into all kinds of supply chains and into production as well. So we'll have to see. But the phenomenon is, I think, pretty easily understandable in terms of the sort of broader transition to political capitalism in this way. It's really an expression of the very narrow opportunities for profitable investment. And there's just not a lot out there. And so it makes a lot of sense that all the investment money is rushing into this one area. The guy who's really good on this analytically, who really lays the foundations of this, is Alvin Hansen, actually, who's this kind of Keynesian economist from the early part of the 20th century, who just has a very interesting take on the underlying dynamics of investment. And that's really what we're seeing here. And so, you know, when, you know, the investment outlets are being clogged up, and so you see everyone jumps into this one area.
And that's geopolitically related to the true closing of the frontier. And I think this is in conscious or unconscious reason that people are trying to colonize the moon, essentially. Like,
I agree with
that
you.
Will be an area. Yeah. I mean, it's not a mistake that is Musk and Bezos. Right. And I mean, I think if we wanted to get cultural studies about it, you could probably link to like this obsession with science fiction and like, why are all of the major capitalists obsessed with like these fantasy worlds and science fiction? It's the searching for new frontiers in a very like literal sense. And I see that I'm in Seattle, the whole project of space colonization is absolutely connected to this unconsciously, I think, for these guys. But it's so clearly a measure of that.
Yeah, I think that's a really interesting observation. So,
yeah, I want to write more about this. So I think now it's time to turn to this fascism issue, because you've been such a major writer on it. We've never had it before. I think I take the hard, it's not fascism line, as people listening know. I think it just really occludes what's happening. But I think in the second Trump term, particularly with the ICE abuses that we saw all over the country, but particularly in Minnesota, and Trump coming in really guns blazing, but seemed like, I think, again, this historical comparison doesn't really hold up to even that much scrutiny, but, you know, gangs of men working for ICE raised the fascism question again. But I'm curious how your thinking began on this and how it has evolved since Trump too.
Well, I'm just going to say that there's a couple of different points I'd like to make on this. The first one is, I think that we should probably make a very important analytic distinction between fascists and fascism as two different things. My own view is that it is undeniable. Like, if you think about someone like Stephen Miller, that person seems to me to be a fascist, right? In the sense that he's articulating a kind of, I mean, he'd be quite comfortable, I think, in a kind of Nazi milieu.
Except the Jewish aspect, which raises interesting questions.
Well,
you know?
Maybe, although, I mean, it is worth recalling that in the early Italian fascist party, there was an overrepresentation of people with Jewish heritage. And the reason for that was that they were often large landowners. So
yes, I think.
My own view is that the question of anti-Semitism is quite orthogonal to the question of fascism. The two came together in National Socialism for very specific reasons. But
yeah, that's true. I guess this is when we get into distinguishing between Nazism and Italian fascism, which is an important analytical distinction. Although I would say in public rhetoric, people think of the Nazis and maybe not the Italians. But sorry, please continue.
It's an interesting sort of intellectual history point, like why people use the generic term fascist to describe the phenomenon. What they really mean is Nazism, which they don't.
Yeah.
But anyway, that's
correct. Yeah.
So my own view is that there are fascists around the government, but that this is not a fascist state and not a fascist society, or you know, and that's kind of the way that I would sort of think about this. And there's lots of reason for why that's.
Dylan, I just have a question. Then, even when we're talking about Miller, so why not just link to like the long, ignominious history of American racism and xenophobia that long predated. I mean, maybe then I'm being too historical and this is just a methodological point, but like there's plenty of Stephen Millers in American history before Mussolini and Hitler. So I'm just like, as an analytical point, why use the European here? And then maybe I'm also being too specific because I began my training as a Europeanist and then I became an Americanist. And when you look at 19th century Europe versus 19th century America, it's very, as you well know, very different. So just as an analytical point, why make the move to use fascism as opposed to the many instances of horrible American racism and xenophobia of the 19th century?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a good question. I think that there, one of the reasons is that I believe that there is at least a bit of explicit toying on the part of the American right today with, you know, fascist intellectuals, fascist rhetoric, fascist tropes, the popularity of Carl Schmitt among this crowd. And I'm not right to say that J.D. Vance cited Carl Schmitt actually in one of his New York Times op-eds or something like that. So I think there's a way in which these guys really want to present themselves. They want to link themselves to that heritage. The importance of Julius Evola in Bannon's sort of past. So there's a kind of, it's not to say, like, it's not as if, it's not as if the actors themselves aren't thinking about this connection. So that would be one kind of point. I guess the other point I would make is that, I mean, of course, I'm largely in agreement with you on the basic thing that whatever we're dealing with here is quite different from interwar fascism for a whole host of reasons. But there's a problem that I think we have as intellectuals as well, which is that we need to think about the relationship between our analytic categories and the political categories that people use to struggle and talk about these things. And I guess I'm not sure, like, if people have decided that they need to mobilize against fascism, is the right response to that to say you have it wrong? like, you're not using the term correctly? Like, what would you go out to a protest or something and say, like, why do you have that car? Why do you have that sign that says these?
No, of course not. Like,
so it's this.
I agree. Yeah, yeah.
About the sort of lay political category and the analytic category is a little bit. I don't know. That's just a. We should be aware that we speak in different registers to different audiences at different times and places.
Totally. And I would never go to a protest. And to me, this is a debate both an academic debate and in a sense a strategic debate, because I do think that diagnosing what is actually going on is the first step in an effective strategy.
I agree.
And I think the fascism frame, conjures images that don't really, as we agree, relate to what we're talking about. And in terms of just the actors categories, to me, that's really interesting. And I've been mulling this essay for a long time. I should probably just write it, which is the decline of the Nazi taboo. I think that's what you're seeing as we move further and further away from World War II and the lived experience of that war. You've seen the taboo around Nazism really dissipate, I think, over a generation, but really in the last 5 or 6 years. And so that, to me, is a very important intellectual phenomenon. I mean, you see it's all over the Trump administration with the images that they use, with the framework that they use, the citing of Carl Schmitt, which is kind of funny because I don't think anyone's citing Carl Schmitt with Telos didn't resurrect him in the 1980s for very different reasons. And I don't know if you know, I did a volume on decisionism, and as I'm sure you're well aware, the decisionist imagination, as we call it, is actually all over Weimar. And I think that Schmitt became popular because he like just said it like so clearly in kind of small books. And so you could read the concept of the political, and it's kind of easier than reading Otto Kirchheimer, who one might think of as a left-wing Schmittian, yeah. Rather. So that is really, really interesting. But why don't we go into your argument about that? Like, why do you think that it isn't a useful analogy? And why hasn't Trump too made you think that, oh, what we're actually dealing with here is fascism?
Well, I mean, the reasons are, I suppose, the reasons I think it's not at least an entirely analogous phenomenon are sort of threefold, I would say. I mean, one of them is that interwar European fascism is just inconceivable without the threat from the left. It's just like the presence of the Soviet threat is everywhere in the source materials, in the ideology, in the forms of organization. Fascism was very much an anti-Bolshevik, anti-communist phenomenon. And I just think that, that's not the same as anti-wokeism. Let's just put it that way. It's just not the same kind of phenomenon. So that's one thing.
Fascism is not anti-wokeism. I agree.
it's not as a value judgment. It's just not, right? The second thing is that I would say is the geopolitical one. So if you look at where fascism emerges and takes root, it's in these sort of rising second or third tier powers. That are really struggling against the pre-existing British hegemony. And, you know, the rhetoric of the proletarian nation, as that goes back to kind of Italian nationalism, kind of summarizes this really well. The fact that fascism is oriented to creating a new geopolitical order is really kind of a central thing. Now, you could say that whatever Trump 2 is doing is also perhaps trying to create a new geopolitical order, as we were talking about. But it's as people have put it, it's like the suicide of a great power or whatever it is a quite different phenomenon from the assertion of a second rank power coming into its own, right? And there is also, I think, connected to this is that fascism, and this is, I guess, the third point, that obviously fascism is this mass mobilizing thing, interwar fascism. It has the party structure, it has the, you know, associational fabric, as I've written about, which is just, I mean, the Republican Party is a very bizarre formation, but it doesn't really have a street presence, right? It just doesn't have that. In the way that happened in the interwar period in Europe. And connected with that too, I think, this is sort of connected to the mobilization aspect, I think that the mass mobilizing warfare of World War I was incredibly important for the fascist experience. And if there's one sort of constant in U.S. politics since the Vietnam War, it's that we do not want to mobilize our population for the purposes of war.
Correct. Especially the elite. You know, like, I what is that? What was that book written about? Oh, God, I forget his name. He was an Austrian historian. But, like, every Italian fascist leader had, like, a very particular experience on the Austro-Italian front during World War I. It was, like, very specific. Right. And so... So yeah, it's like when you get into the historical particularities, you just see how much of a difference that it has. And so maybe just as a final question, this might be a little bit beyond your bailiwick, but you've thought about this. Why do you think the analogy has been so attractive? Why was there this fascism debate, which I think is receding into history because I think Trump is increasingly looking like a lame duck, and that we're entering a post-Trump era. And I think this is going to be a debate very much confined to the era of high Trumpism, one might call it. But why do you think there was a debate? Why do you think people were so attracted to it when I think you and I are both quite skeptical of it?
I think part of the reason is that we don't have a language for talking about this political formation, which is emerging, which is clearly, in my view, a qualitative break, but that we don't yet know exactly how to describe it. And so people reach for, you know, other qualitative breaks in the past that seem analogous in some way. I mean, it's the same phenomenon that Marx talks about at the beginning of the 18th Brumaire, which is that, you know, why is it that all the French revolutionaries presented themselves in the guise of these classical heroes? And, you know, they talked about the Republic and the Empire and this and that. It's because they had a political language and they were trying to act out what were really qualitatively new kinds of political forms using this older political language. So I actually think it's an interesting and general phenomenon, an important phenomenon that, you know, the new is born in the ideological political wrappings of the old. That's just what happens. I guess that would be my kind of general take.
Some might say the dead generations lay upon the minds of the living, if you were. I do have a final question, because I think I have a unique take on MAGA that I don't see many people share, is that I actually don't think it has much of a future. I think that there is no interest in building the hegemony that you saw with a genuine social transformation like during the New Deal or during Reagan. I think it is a grasping, venal phenomenon that is only going to enrich a series of elites. My stupid joke, which everyone listening has heard, is that at some point you need to do the socialism in the National Socialism. And we could argue to what degree the Nazis were doing that. But I think there was at least a rhetoric and a framework of like Kraft Deutsche Freude and all of that stuff, particularly in the early years of the Gleichschaltung and the hegemonic building project. And I just think there's no interest or capacity amongst MAGA or the far right to do that. So I actually think this is going to be viewed not as a blip, but as a passing phenomenon for whatever comes next. And I don't think we know what comes next. But I'm curious your just to take on MAGA, where you think I'm wrong here, and then we'll end there.
So I think I would distinguish MAGA politics from Trumpism. And maybe that's what I would say about it. So I think you're completely right about the short to medium term, I think, you know, the Trumpist phenomenon is in serious political electoral trouble. I mean, I think it's really very obvious. The problem is, though, I tend to be a little bit, maybe a little more, I don't know if pessimistic is quite the right word, but I do think that there's a continuing basis for a kind of right-wing politics that has a substantial working class base going forward. And it would take the form of what you're talking about, a more sort of seriously national socialist kind of thing. I mean, and you can see the intellectual elements of this, you know, in, you know, the kind of Claremont group, and then the some of the people who write for American Affairs, there's a project there. it's very hard. I mean, the problem from for those people is that they're stuck with the Republican Party, right?
Precisely. We're not a parliament, you know? The structure limits this influence of those people. Sorry. Just like it influences the limit of the left.
Yeah, that's right. That's exactly the problem that they have. And so I don't know if they can, you know, I'm not sure if they can really, carry it forward. They would have to. I mean, in some ways, you could say they have been remarkably successful in transforming the Republican Party. But what they transformed it into was not the thing that they wanted exactly, I would say. On the other hand, like, you know, so I don't see the, I feel that what is likely to happen is that the sort of center right of the Democratic Party will be greatly strengthened by the midterm elections. It will learn exactly the wrong lessons. And it will, we'll see a kind of a reassertion of a kind of, you know, technocratic neoliberalism. That's what I think is going to happen. They see their political model as Peter Madjar, which is interesting, right? Because that person is quite conservative. I mean, it's so I think that's the kind of politics. And I think it's that politics might have quite a promising short to medium term future in the sense in electoral terms. But if that happens, then all of the things that created MAGA politics are going to be exacerbated again. And, I don't know, maybe a Tucker Carlson or maybe one of the Trump sons would have a more seriously national socialist politics. Is it possible that that could break through? It doesn't seem like it's impossible that that could be an enduring feature of the political system. So I would say I agree with you about Trumpism, but I guess I'm less sure about MAGA.
I am also quite pessimistic. I always joke about we are in the era of mutual ruin. So that happening is unfortunately, I wouldn't be surprised if this is the lesson that the Democratic Party takes from what looks to be the electoral drubbing of Trump. And then this also raises larger questions, which you don't have time for now. But I've got a book coming out this summer on imperialist realism. And one of the major things I argue is about the end of mass politics. And could you have a national socialist type phenomenon without mass politics, I think very much remains to be seen, but that would be something genuinely new in the 21st century. But Dylan, just to wrap up, thank you so much for joining us. I had a great time and we would love to have you back again soon. And I am such a fan of your work and thank you so much for taking the time.
Thanks a lot, Danny. It was great. And I'd be happy to come back anytime. Yeah.